Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
We're leaving today and entering a world of Mickey Mouse waving, princess meeting and greeting, lightsaber clashing, the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror dropping, Banshee flying, Space Mountain launching, galaxy rewinding, what's the whole network galaxy rewinding, fireworks igniting, world of other worlds, for whatever you love, infinite worlds await at the most magical place on Earth, Walt Disney World Resort.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need. From athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist! Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe white-tailed deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Hi, I'm John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. This is Maximize Your Hunt. Welcome back, everybody. Hopefully, everybody's doing well. I know a lot of people are probably working in their properties, and it's a great time For most of us, some that have a extended winter season with a lot of snow, this is a tough time of year to be out there. Some areas in upstate New York have feet of snow on the ground currently, and I know that's a difficult thing for some of you also. Praise everybody for, you know, taking time to get out there. Folks in the South, if your seasons have finished, hopefully you're out there, you know, starting to plan your burn schedule and things of that nature. Just want to mention a couple things. First off, I have my master class. I'm going to announce it here for the first time coming up in July. It's July 18th, 2026. There'll be information on my website. Some of those that have pre-signed up for it, I didn't do a pre-sign up, but you contacted me and I put you on a list. I've sent those emails out to you all. If you're going to attend, you need to respond in order to attend the event. It will have limited space this year. There will be several speakers. Of course, I will be the primary speaker. You'll be on my property. My property is about 15, 20 minutes south of Syracuse, New York, so in central New York. I would request that if you're coming here, there's some local places to stay, and you know, you'll have a pretty fun-filled day. If you cannot walk 2.5 to 3 miles, we'll say 2 to 3 miles, I would recommend not coming. It's probably something that you wouldn't do well at, because there's some hills and hollers and things of that nature. So it's quite a bit to walk. And we're going to try to walk as much of the property as we can. And I want to show you every aspect of the design and things that I think through. We're going to go through my bedding area layouts, how I cut things. You know, we're going to get in the details. You're going to see stuff that you've not seen on any other, I'm sure, any other hunting property. You're also going to see a landscape that is very interesting, and some features of me integrating food plots into hillsides and benches, and the methodology of cutting and tree planting, and everything comes out with like putting everything together in a very detailed approach. And so my method and my madness in this, you know, I'll explain some of my thinking and my ideology around design and build. So we'll teach you some of those things. We'll do a timber session, and I may do a podcast on the masterclass just to help have people think through some of the topics that, you know, we want to navigate, or you should be navigating on your property, you know, when you're building your property. I also want to mention Perry Batten. Perry Batten is working in the Midwest. Perry's out of that Missouri, Illinois area. He's working out in the Midwest doing work with Whitetail Landscapes, and really excited to have Perry on board. He's wealth of knowledge and he's great to work with. And Thomas Mills, of course, you know, I'm close with Thomas. We're all kind of collaborating together. So there's been quite a bit of support. You know, next year, potentially I may come out and do some more work in the Midwest to support Perry. If you would like me on your property with Perry, you need to let me know. I would be kind enough and supportive enough to be a part of that process and happy to help folks. This is your chance to level up. If you want detailed, direct, pragmatic, high level, but complex and well thought out ideas, this is your chance for those in the Midwest. And you know, be ready to think outside the box, because that's exactly how I approach design. And Perry, obviously, is learning with me, and he will be a great resource for you out in the field. Couple topics, and this topic that we're going to focus on today is talking about the difference from the Midwest and the Northeast specifically. This is not to generalize, but to have an idea that there are differences. And one of the things that has swayed me a little bit is I've had clients say, why do people not understand what it's like in the Northeast? I said, well, they've never lived it. They lived their life and they've lived hunting these environments. And some environments in the Midwest are just as difficult as parts of the Northeast. And some parts of the Northeast have similarities to the Midwest. But in this podcast discussion, we're going to get on into some key topics. One is understanding landscape vigilance. And vigilance to me, and there's probably a million different definitions, but for deer and behavioral ecology, it's focused on a deer monitoring its environment. It's detecting threats and it's improving its chance of survival based on its level of vigilance in these areas where there's increased predation or other factors. And we'll talk about the reasons why some of these states are different. What are the factors that make one state harder to hunt than another state? And one of the things I'll mention in this podcast is putting people on a pedestal. I very rarely look at any hunting celebrity as all knowledgeable and knowing. I'm not all knowledgeable and knowing, but I know enough from credentials and experience that very few of those individuals, including people that consult in this field, have any experience here where deer populations are low and hunting pressure is high. There's maybe just a couple. I don't even know if there's a couple that have that level of experience. And in doing so, as I travel out to the Midwest, things get a little simpler for me. And I appreciate that because I can take some of these really complex ideas that I have and now start to apply them in different areas. The other thing I was mentioning, and I've got a client coming up, and he called me about his landscape and landscape diversity. And he was, he's like, hey, I've got all this great stuff I want to show you. And I haven't even met with him, but I really have enjoyed talking to him. And he said, well, I had this idea. I got it off a YouTube page, and it's these diversity pockets out in the field. And I said, okay, well, you know, what did you do? And he said, well, I planted it in a circle. I like that. These diversity pockets of different types of species. I said, okay, what was your objective? I didn't have one. I just saw it on YouTube and I want to apply it on the landscape because we need more diversity in our properties. And you talk about biodiversity on your podcast. I said, wonderful. I said, let's take that same principle and let's forget that you did it in a 20 by 20 foot section. And I guess this is a copy version of what someone had done on the YouTube channel. I don't know which channel it was. And I said, let's do that on the entire property. Let's take a vegetation variance where we have two different vegetation types. And let's try to create variation between them. Let's add some plants into that. The highest interest points are going to be generally for deer in between those two ecotones, forming a quote unquote edge. And that's going to create a reference point, a mapping in their internal, you know, mindset of where they want to go and what areas they want to seek out. That's what you want to create. And you want to create it on your entire property, not just a 20 foot by 20 foot section. So I said, you know, my mindset is to expand that idea, which is a novel idea in some capacity. It's a novel idea. You know, you're making a change to a field and you're adding diversity in there, but applying it within your property. And then that same principle, this was a different client. So I had done a field conversion for a client here several months ago and very beautiful property. Big field conversion. It was a great project. I'd love to share that on the podcast, but I don't think he's going to allow it to be released. Some of the information that I give these clients, they treat it as, you know, individual sensitive. And I have to have that in confidence, but it's a dendritic design where we've kind of done layering and layouts. There's nothing in blocks. It's all irregular edges. Before he started thinking through the process of implementing it, he said to me, he's like, I've been watching, I don't want to name his name, but I've been watching this guy and they're big on miscanthus and switchgrass. And I said, cool, we got some switchgrass in there. And he's like, well, but it's not enough. And I said, well, how much switchgrass do you think you need? And he said, I think we need more. I'm like, you know, in your area with your snow load and ice, like I wouldn't have any more than you currently have. I think it's great screening and we've used it to break up areas and just create movement and flow. I said, but it's going to be over applied. I said, I do not want it to exceed 10%. In fact, in your design, I have it down to like 8 to 9% in total accumulation across this pretty large area. And he said to me, he's like, but I was watching this YouTube guy or celebrity or whatever, and they've got miscanthus and switchgrass. And I said, okay, I have never been, and I have miscanthus on my property for screening. Okay. So I don't want to forget about that. And that's in part of a 4-layer screen, but I've never seen any general animal activity ever in the history of ever and ever and ever on my property where miscanthus provided some ecosystem services or benefit to what I can tell the landscape around it. It doesn't associate well with the soil biology, and it basically is a loner out there, but it provides decent structure. I'm like, there are 50 alternatives to that in your area, this client specifically. I said, let's look at this more dimensionally. Let's look at the volume of switchgrass I think you need. And he said, well, what's your history with switchgrass? I said, simply this, I did my first field conversion over 20 years ago. So when I was in my 20s, I basically took my a portion of my father's farm. I broke it up into sections. At the time, it was revolutionary for me. I had a no-till drill. This is 20 years ago, over 20 years ago. And I said, I basically made crosses and X's and I had all these diversity pockets. And I said, that concept has not changed for me in 20 years. I mean, I've refined it so it flows better and it works better for properties, and I've refined my processes around it, but the principles still hasn't changed. That worked 20 years ago. And I said, in that example, it's probably 20% of the design. And after, you know, succession has happened, it's probably less than 10% of the design. And he's like, that works well. I said, it works fantastic. That's the thing you have to realize is we think a lot of these, you know, plants are silver bullets. Well, there's a lot of different things that you can add, and the combination of them will be more functional on the landscape. We need to think about like function of a plant to be, you know, what wildlife habitat does it provide? Is it fixing an area? Some are used for soil building. Some are good for cultivating if they have deep fibrous roots. And I use some of these for erosion control where there's any slopes. So like there's a lot of purpose behind some of these species. Switchgrass kind of fits that niche, but you know, you've got other plants that you could use in there that are more functional for wildlife. Like a good example would be Eastern white pine. Should be a highly sought after plant, and it provides wildlife food. It's got a windbreak. There's a lot of habitat value for breeding bird communities. It can be used for erosion control and hedges. And I don't think in sectary benefits as well. I don't think that switchgrass does everything that a tree does. And I don't think that miscanthus does everything the Eastern white pine does, but they can function in a similar manner. So when you're thinking about a plant's function, don't think I like miscanthus for one reason. I like it because it takes up a small space. It can be easily removed on the landscape and it can be replaced. And it could be a temporary buffer. You could use it as a temporary buffer. I've done it on client properties where I've done switchgrass screen and a temporary buffer. That can be highly valued on the landscape. Absolutely 100% valued. But there are other options to provide more ecological benefits on the landscape that we should consider. And I would employ people to start really evaluating that and thinking a little bit more dimensional. And those people that are promoting those different items, they could be a product supplier. That could be a reason why. They may see its physical benefit, and I do as well. But I think there's 100 different things. And if you're doing a field conversion, that would be low on my list. The other thing I want to mention is deer's cognitive ability. I'll talk a little bit more on the podcast. I think deer, we mentioned this a lot in this podcast, and sometimes the guests mention it, and they say, you know, deer aren't that smart. And I think deer are smart. I think there's a lot of intelligence to an animal that has good sensory function that can evaluate its particular domain. Because if they weren't that smart, why are big bucks so hard to seek and kill? Like if they were really, really smart, they would invade us all the time and then break. There's been numerous studies and occurrences where even in fenced areas, they cannot capture and find certain deer. They're there. They exist, but they can't find them. And, you know, that's a big piece of realizing how complicated an animal can be. The other topic we're going to get to on this podcast that's relevant is talking more about landscape predictability. And when I'm designing a property, and this isn't a hard concept to, I think, appreciate, but when I'm designing a property, we want reliability and consistency in resources. And that's part of the landscape. But the other piece of it is an animal that's risk averse, where there's a lot of hunting pressure. We want to lower those risk factors and give the animal the items they need in influence, as well as human presence, the things that create negatives like human interaction or predator interaction. And we want to influence their deer mat, their deer movement and behavior such that they are more comforted in their environments. And so as we create these different resource distributions and we try to minimize some of the environmental factors and we work with the topography and terrain, and including some factor of disturbance, human interaction, fire, all those things, there's a rhythm, like a rhythm that we want to start thinking about when we're making these changes. And we want to minimize threat perception. There's a concept that we talked about with one of the biologists here a few years ago, landscape of fear. We want to minimize the animal's perception of negatives on the landscape. And why the differences are the way they are on these different properties or different areas or different regions is predominantly based on that. And then the factors where human activity on the conservation side has failed, absolutely failed, And I'd love to be more of an advocate for having better stewardship of our land and better stewardship of our animals and being more educated on that topic. That's why we have the National Deer Alliance. But some of you all could probably educate more and think what people need to know in that concept, because we are, in some cases, our own worst enemies. All right, here's the rest of the podcast. All right, so we're going to get into a topic that I think is really important. And this is from a client that had asked me to do a podcast talking about the differences in some of the areas that he has hunted in, as well as there's a lot of differences in consultants in different areas, and they have different experiences from a, you know, hunting complexity standpoint. And he wanted to get my take on the differences in certain areas. And the certain areas are, I've worked in the Midwest and I live in the Northeast, and I predominantly hunt in the Northeast. So I'm going to give a quick recap on a property that I worked on a few years ago out in Ohio. So this is 3 years ago. I was able to go out to a good area in Ohio, pretty good deer numbers. An area where there's some management, there's definitely some hunting pressure, but it's not nearly as significant as the hunting pressure that I've seen in the Northeast. I would say an average, in some of the areas that I work on, for every 20 acres, there's about one hunter. That's kind of the threshold. And so you can kind of do some rough math on 20, 50, you know, people per square mile. It ranges depending on these areas. I've hunted some areas where there's five guys on 10 acres or 10 guys on 20 acres. So there's some significant hunting pressure in some of these areas. Now, that's not to say that every area in the Midwest or Northeast is exactly the same, and that's not to generalize, but on this property I went to work on, I went there during hunting season. It was in October. It was during their archery season, and the client had asked me, owns multiple properties, asked me to do some cutting. Now, I don't know why I went out there. Certainly dedicated to that client, because that's prime time for me here in upstate New York. But I went out there to go visit that client. I really was dedicated to improving this property, and we need to put in some changes. And he had other properties to hunt, so his priority was not that individual piece. As I'm there working and consulting, and I did run chainsaw for a little bit of time when I was out there, there were bucks all over the place. They were kind of in that, you know, pre-rut period. They were still posturing in fields and sparring during daylight hours. And I sat there and I said, you know, I've seen at least 4 to 5 bucks that are like of significant antler configuration, like 150, 160 inch bucks that are out in these fields. I can stalk up to these deer. They're in the woods adjacent to me as I'm walking around. They pay no attention to the level of pressure. Now, granted, I look around and I'm like, okay, there's a box blind over there. There's hunting pressure over there. You know, I know there's hunting pressure around, but it's not that significant in comparison. And they've had years and years and years. They've been pre-programmed to have a limited amount of hunting pressure. And as a result, the deer are a little fearless. Now, this is on one particular property. This is not saying the entire state of Ohio or Iowa or Illinois is like this, but this is an example, a bit fearless. Now, you do the same thing. I'm driving back to New York and I'm thinking, I'll never see 4 or 550 inch deer in the next 10 years, maybe the next 20 years in these properties. Now, granted, I killed 150 inch deer on my little 46 acres here, and that's an anomaly. Would it happen again in the next several years? Potentially, the whole environment would have to change. There have to be, you know, less hunting pressure, people passing deer. We have low deer numbers here, and the demographic overall, you know, the breakup of males to females and just the numbers. When you start doing the math, it takes a lot of deer in abundance, population-wise, to get to a 4 or 5 age class deer. You know, in some of these areas where there's 20 or 30 year-and-a-half-year-old bucks running around, as you start to weed the garden, so to speak, you can make that jump to 3, 4, 5 years old. It starts with a pretty good base population. Now, oversaturation or too many deer in the landscapes, that depletes the habitat quality. You know, the other factors like physiology, their general health goes down. But there's also benefits to these larger deer numbers in these particular areas, especially when there's low pressure. Their vigilance goes down tremendously because there's many eyes searching the landscape, scanning areas for pressure. So, you know, when I look at some of these properties that don't view humans as a negative, and it's been that way for many, many moons, that transcends to lower vigilance. Now, vigilance is a topic we mentioned earlier, and it's something that I think maybe just by definition, just to have it on the table, is it's when an animal is monitoring its environment and its surroundings of and worried about threats or predators. Human could be a predator in that equation, wolves, etc., that may be a direct impact to that animal. And, you know, these animals survived based on their adoption of, learning to deal with flight risks or learning to deal with early detection and avoidance. And so just like any other, animal that's on the landscape, having an anti-predator response is pretty typical. And so there's absolutely behavioral indicators that we see, like cues on the landscape, is how active is an animal when it goes to an open area? Is it in a feeding posture or is it an alert posture? As it ears back, what's its body positioning? How does it posture when it eats forage? Like, you could look at an animal's physical presence and have a good idea if that animal is in flight mode. And generally, they're not in fight mode. They're in flight mode. So if they're spending a lot of time looking around their particular areas and not feeding, they may not achieve the nutritional demands that they need. And so we want animals going into open spaces and balancing that time where they're vigilant versus the time that they're eating. Hopefully they're eating more than being vigilant. And so all those influences, whether it's the number of animals with eyes in the landscape, the habitat quality, the amount of human activity, the risk of worry with predation, those factors all come into these equations. And so all those correlations and sometimes causations have created an opportunity to shift a deer's behavior. So think about this. You've had many, many years of hunting pressure, and we're talking about high frequency, long duration seasons, the style and methodology of hunting, deer drives, those type of things. What's that done is taken their normal activity and transition it into a negative. And the deer move less. They use different forms of cover at a higher rate. They travel with, basically wind and hearing and visual at their advantage more times than not. And their overall vigilance increases. So deer have learned to adapt, and they adapt over a short period of time. And there's different locality pressures. And some of those locality pressures could be car interfacing. We know for a fact that some animals don't want to go across roads, but we also know that that's created a fear factor with these particular animals. And some areas, the deer mind the cars. They see their siblings get hit by vehicles. There's an awareness factor, and they do have cognitive abilities. They have memory. They gutturally respond to and realize that, that there's impacts around them. Their ability to remember good areas to go from a safety standpoint, eating quality food, knowing those areas exist. They have a interred map layout of the areas that they visit. And when they have a dangerous encounter, that complexity changes their relationship to the time they feed, how they move, et cetera, in the landscape. So their risk awareness and acuteness to risk goes up. Everything's elevated. Their senses are elevated. Their behavior adjusts. And they're going to pick different habitat preferences based on that to minimize that human predator interaction. And I know a lot of this should be common sense, but people ask me all the time, why is it different in the Midwest? Frankly, it's easier. That's a generalization, but it is easier. The areas that I've worked in are easier because their behavior is different, at least from a hunting standpoint. You don't have a 200-inch deer running around, open ground like that, that has no sense of its surrounding, or at least no worry about a predator interaction when it has high pressure. It just doesn't happen. So when you see these individuals killing these really big deer on these consistent properties, you know that they've created an environment of low pressure. And that's a positive. Those are things you want to replicate on your property. You want the deer to walk on your property and have a different sense of things. However, most of the properties that we work on, that I own personally, of course, they don't encompass a big enough area to house an animal for its entire life cycle. So what that means is the factors around you are going to impact your deer. So it's not you just being cognitively aware of the social development of these animals and how they develop, their awareness factor. It's realizing that people around you are impacting these deer, and having a good kind of environmental and social awareness of what's happening around you is a part of this thing. So you can build an amazing property, but again, if you have this environment where, you know, the animal's having to adapt and really focused on its sensory aspects, it is going to, from a maximum focus standpoint, you know, emphasize and use all those sensory features to their advantage, and they're going to place themselves in ideal conditions to minimize interaction with active predators. We've had podcast discussions about wolves and mountain lions on here, and what does that do? It just increases the amount of vigilance an animal has to have. So one of our goals is to lower the baseline vigilance of a particular animal. These larger contiguous tracts that have good cover is a start. And properties that are somewhat fragmented, I think about portions of the Midwest. There are fragmented landscapes where there's big open fields and just a small woodlot. That animal is going to produce higher vigilance, assuming there's hunting pressure or there's an anti-predator reaction because there's predators on the landscape. And they're going to make shorter movements, they're going to use edge at a higher interval. Travel corridors matter in that situation. So a lot of you that have properties that are unwilling to do field conversions and are willing to attach a piece of cover to a piece of cover, you're losing out because your landscape structure is somewhat fragmented. And again, we want good visibility for the animal, but we want escape cover and good travel corridors connecting them. And also remember, there's other external factors. And these external factors really, I feel like, really impact the deer. I mentioned, you know, at the start of this, the winter severity is high. Well, these areas that have mild climates that, you know, the deer can eat all over the place and they don't have the issue of high snow loads and cold temperatures and wind, they're much better off. So you get the seasonality effects of the Midwest. It's nothing compared to Northeast when it comes to, now temperature-wise, it could be comparable, but when it directly correlates to snow load, they're not even in the same marker. I mean, we've got areas in the Northeast get 150 inches, 200, 300 inches a year, 300 on the extreme, but at least 150 inches a year, particularly where I live. Those are big things that regionally change their behavior and move deer to different locations. So here's a generalization. In the areas that have a lot of hunting pressure, that take a lot of deer, New York State's a good example of those, the deer have a tendency, when they have a lower or younger age structure, to be more nervous and reactive. Older age classes or more deer with more age class within that structure, they have a tendency to be calmer, just in general. And so when I see these properties that have annual movements, the rate of return to areas is consistent. They are not impacted, not only based on the environmental conditions as much, but the social and hunting pressure elements. And so they're able to make these routine movements on an annual basis. And that indicates to me a low pressure area. I'm not saying deer in high pressure areas will not make routine movements, but I can tell you in 10 years of monitoring many of these areas that I've hunted on, I have never seen one buck do the same thing on the same day ever. In fact, it's very rare because, again, I have a younger age class, that buck even survives to the next age class. And it can't routinely do the same things it would. And the ones that do survive, they do not. If a deer makes a mistake twice, it dies in these areas. That's how critical it is. And I would suggest anybody who wants to see, or maybe you don't ever want to see this, because I would much rather be in a situation where the hunting was easier, and I think many people would be. If you ever want to see this, come hunt Syracuse, New York. Come hunt some of these areas. Go to areas where there's a lot of pressure and there's low deer numbers. And that return to location, that consistency, that annual rate of return happens very rarely. I was talking to my partner the other day, and he was telling me, you know, all these years I've hunted, I've had these great spots. And we gain and lose spots all the time. He said, I've never killed a deer out of the same tree stand. And it goes to show you that there's an awareness factor that these deer have, going back to that sensory integration or sensory and problem solving piece of deer. Again, any animal that's going downwind to check the locations, analyzing a situation, it has an avoidance of perceived danger. And it knows those tree stand locations. It's been educated. And so, you know, these situations, and what he said to me is like, well, you're designing these design hunts on these particular properties that, even though you have a consistent tree stand location, you have the features built well enough that keeps the correct amount of space, that keeps the correct amount of physical orientation between an animal and a human, but also separates their movements so they don't connect with one another. I said, yeah, that's my job. Designed farms or designed properties for hunting purposes, at least for white-tailed deer, have to have all these factors built into them. Because again, once an animal has awareness of your presence, that becomes a problem to that hunting location. So you have to minimize those things. So here's some regional differences. We'll just take the Northeast and parts of the upper Midwest. New York, Pennsylvania, kind of in that northeast window, and the areas of the Midwest, kind of, we'll just say Michigan, parts of Michigan and parts of Wisconsin. Those areas, generally speaking, depending on the volume of pressure, most of the deer behavior is extremely vigilant. There are more nighttime movement than I've seen, at least working with clients, and I've worked in all these areas. And even in those nocturnal movements, those are a factor of that individual small little region. And that's a factor in deer's consistency and probability to be killed. So if their probability of kill goes down, it's like because they're hyper-vigilant and they're aware of their environments. They're using thicker areas, swamp edges, regen cuts, and they're spending more time paying attention to their sensory factors. And really the causes are simply this. And Michigan is a prime example. Long, intense gun season, high hunter density, fragmented forest. That could also mean forests that are an even age forest with not much diversity. And they're not always, but many times rely on terrain in those situations more than vegetation. But that doesn't always mean those areas have a lot of terrain features. And in general, you know, the generational hunting pressure that's occurred over those areas, and I think Wisconsin especially, has really created a major disturbance where these animals are learning that people are the apex predator, even if you have wolves. All right, let's take a quick look at the Midwest. So Midwest, a little bit different, you know, states like Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, those states. Their movement's typically highly patterned. Unless the urban sprawl continues to happen, a lot of those rural areas is very consistent with what's being planted, the routine of folks. There's consistency in the landscape. Their animals' movement itself is highly patternable, and that makes hunting quite a bit easier. I do notice in a lot of those areas there is a strong emphasis on edge, and those timber ag interfaces tend to be the highest point of interception for hunters. And generally speaking, they don't need as much cover to be calm. And so a lot of these individuals that are doing drone studies right now all over the place, and they're trying to critique or evaluate deer behavior and movement, it's a symptom of those environments. Again, I've said this many times on this podcast, I cannot overemphasize that point. That is a symptom of that environment. That is not a descriptor. You cannot apply that in generalities. And people take that information and say, silver bullet answer, let's go. We're going to go with it. And you know, these animals in these areas, and I'm generalizing quite a bit here, once an animal gets an open area, if it is acting in a manner where it's not overly cautious, and I think about some of the hunting videos I used to watch, you're in a low pressure area. If there's a congruence of animals and socially high interaction between those animals, likely you're in a low pressure area. Look at that animal's individual physique, its attitude, its movements. And, you know, these animals have a strong perception of their environment. And as they continue to assess their environment and problem solve what's happening on the environment, they're going to navigate these areas differently. And so there's different movements, and their relationship to movement areas of high pressured areas versus low pressure areas. And this should be a good description of you all when you're looking at your properties. When an animal comes to an open field, how does it react? And that's kind of one of those litmus tests. I'm going to give you some analytical pieces of this to think about, but vigilance is going to change when the animal's environment changes. And there are correlations that you can absolutely kind of like use as a basis of observation. So if there's no movement during daylight hours, there's likely excessive intrusion during hunting season or a human disturbance that is significant in disturbing that animal. If deer circle downwind, and they can circle downwind for many reasons, but if it happens 100 or 90% of the time, that is a factor of being, that is a factor of an animal being wary of its location. And I'm not talking about during the rut periods. I'm talking about all season long. Deer will use, they will move in many different manners and intercept the bedding areas or access the bedding areas from a downwind position. Tight bedding clusters. Deer bedding in tight bedding clusters typically identify to me that there's fragmentation in the landscape. They're not able to spread out. You want your animals spread on the landscape for disease and social reasons and those type of things. And then number one, without question, how long are these animals feeding, particularly in open areas? I've done a little bit of research and evaluation on this, and I have like some anecdotal bits of information of seeing how long deer stay in bedding areas. And if you have a low pressure environment, you know, how they use those bedding areas. But I noticed them staying in bedding areas a lot longer in conditions where those drastically open areas or field settings are present in the landscape. So they'll pick cover over open areas. And that seems pretty basic, but again, it's their perception of risk. And, you know, animals that have erratic movement and they're constantly on edge, sometimes that's a matter of just a predator issue. One of the factors that I think we should be really evaluated at a much higher rate in some of these areas, especially with low deer populations and even high deer population, is what is the predator to prey relationship? We focus on buck to doe relationships, but what about the predator prey relationship? That is a big factor in aspects of deer and thinking about, you know, what's critical on the landscape. So I will do a podcast on designing a hunting property around some of these things. But the bottom line is deer are generally, without human interaction, they're not nervous. They're not inherently nervous, and they should be calm. We've conditioned them based on us, and this is years and years, generational activity, to be more aware of predators, the human pressure and inconsistency in human pressure. We'll talk about that in a second. And a term I like to call landscape predictability. Landscapes consistently provide opportunities for animals to be housed and provide them a benefit. And as we change those things, or we basically de-escalate them so they're not as valued in the landscape, that changes their overall movement. So I'll get into some of the specifics when it comes to those elements of design in a separate podcast. But there's kind of like a few like important levers that I'll talk about in that podcast is thinking about the predator and human pressure in the equation of design, considering landscape predictability, and we'll talk about that now, and then valuing the amount of food, cover, travel risk, the issues that come with those three items and how to put them together. So as you're programming an area behaviorally to be more hospitable to deer, that you're consistent. And as you shift all those to a positive, the animal interaction becomes positive. So now the Northeast is as good as parts of the Midwest. And so we do better selection decisions. We shoot the lower quality deer. We emphasize change in the herd itself and the demographic of that herd. And next thing you know, portions of the Northeast, Pennsylvania, New York, Vermont, those areas start to get better. And you're seeing portions of these areas produce good quality deer, but those are smaller regions in the overall context. Let's talk about a little bit about landscape predictability. And this is really kind of a misunderstood concept in deer. And it really breaks down to, you know, what deer experience in the landscape, what we control, and what that does to vigilance and how that changes. So, you know, landscape predictability to me is kind of based around the feeling of deer having a quote unquote safe space. Do they feel safe where they're not as disturbed and they can move freely without negative human interaction? It's not about making the land simple. It's about actually adding some complexity to the land and making sure that, you know, physically, spatially, there's consistency in how they move in the landscape. And then deer are generally survivors, and their cognitive ability has given them the rationale, the ability to evaluate their area. You know, and some deer have higher intellect than other deer. On average, you would say all deer score a B or a C, but some deer are more astute, and that has, you know, weighed well in their ability to survive. And that's across the entire United States. You know, the deer in the Northeast aren't any smarter on average than the deer in the Midwest, but the deer in the Northeast have elevated senses because of the environment that they persist in. And deer read the landscape differently. You know, and these are the questions you need to ask. As a deer builds its internal map, it's asking itself, how do I survive? How do I not get in areas where I'm going to be constantly disturbed? Where's the danger coming from? How do I move between these food, bed and cover areas with the least amount of uncertainty? And if we try to create a positive answer to those, landscape predictability increases and pressure is random. Their vigilance spikes. So we're the ones that can change some aspects of this. And so here's some of the four components that I would look at when you're thinking about landscape predictability. And this is kind of a where, when scenario. Where is the danger coming from? Does it come from the same place every time? And a lot of times when we have roads around our areas, they become aware of the roads. That doesn't mean a deer perceives its environment the same way. The threats are the same as humans perceive threats. So cars go up and down roads every day. The animal's interaction with the road is one where they may or may not, the inconsistency of movement may build an inconsistency in travel. And so their interaction may be irregular. So the occurrence of a deer and collision with a car may be a direct factor of the inconsistency in that activity. And that's generally what we see on the road systems is cars come at intervals. And those intervals may change. They may be sporadic. And as the hunting pressure pulls into an area versus being on the outer edges of property, that changes an animal's presence in a particular area. And they have a feeling that they need to move out. Interior sanctuaries never being entered is a big piece of that. And deer learn where they can relax. And a lot of times, if there's pressure, they consolidate their bedding into a particular area. We want them to spread out their bedding and parcel themselves out through, you know, the different areas. And their travel routes, you know, having very stable, consistent travel routes, creating these environments. And in our design, we have five different types of travel. And in these types of travel, we try to stabilize their movements from one area to the next. And then, you know, is it temporal? You know, are the things that are happening in the landscape, are they happening at predictable times? Maybe you're going to work on your property. You need to work every Saturday and Sunday and don't work, you know, Monday through Friday. But be consistent about how you access your property, and random intrusion on the property can be a negative. Off-season wandering or not having a plan and not parceling out activity throughout the year in a consistent fashion will impact your deer. It just absolutely will. I've been on my property multiple times, and the habitat is so good that even the pressure that I create, they just still don't want to leave. But that doesn't mean that all deer feel that way. Some deer will want to exit those areas, and they adjust to the pressure around them. The daylight activity, you want it to increase. There needs to be some safe windows for the animal. Like, don't put pressure on major movement times on your particular property. And here's the result. When the deer are scanning their environments less, they're going to move more. And if you have high quality habitat, they don't need to move as far. One of the stories this year on my property, this is the greatest story I think in the world. And this just emphasizes what there are differences. So I had two bucks that I went after. I killed the 1B buck. The 1A buck, I was really hoping he was going to make it. After I killed the first deer, the main buck that was it was a 4-year-old deer that I have quite a bit of history with since he was 2 years old. He was daylight active on my property, for 19 out of 20 days during the rut. During a 20-day period, he was there for 19 days. He left for one day, and then he was back for five. He spent a good chunk of the rest of the season on my property, but for an entire breeding period, let's say from November 1st to November 19th, he was there every single day. That's 46 acres, one buck. That's a mature buck. I did not have another mature buck on camera other than that individual deer on that property. So you can change a deer's movement cycle and pattern if you have the right conditions. And for a deer to spend that much time, you know, these deer I've seen on these major, I've worked in big agricultural areas, and I watched a buck, I was driving, and I wish I had a tag on this deer. I saw him 5 miles away in a really weird rack configuration. This is down by a family farm property. And I was in this area, and 5 miles away, that same exact buck in one day, that deer traveled five miles. I've got a deer on my property, not moving at all. Now that could be that individual deer. So we don't want to say that that is the rule. That could be the exception rule, but I've seen that multiple times on my property. And it is because I have a decent balance of of bucks to does, and I have a fair parceling in that demographic, but I also have a deer swamping issue. When you create really good quality habitat, you suck in these deer from all these areas, and that creates a whole host of other pressures where these deer in these low quantity or low populous environments, they may not be as socially adapt to that. There's other pieces of this that come into play. And animals' vigilance is somewhat individual too. Sometimes when they're in groupings, they are more comfortable. Sometimes when they're individual, they're less comfortable. So you have to think about that in the landscape. And also to consider this is another just kind of curveball in this equation. There are some circumstances where I'll just take a lactating doe that just had a fawn. They spend a lot of time foraging. And they have a fawn that's positioned somewhere in the landscape. And the goal is to not have that mother bring her offspring all over the place. And their cortisol levels or their stress levels, a lot of these fawns are much higher in these areas that are highly pressured. And it could be a predation response, but more than likely it's not. It's the mother's fear of its young being impacted by its environment. In these fragmented environments, there's habitat that's not well connected. One of the issues, 100%, is having the right form of habitat in a large volume so these does do not have to spend a lot of times foraging and moving in those areas. When they have long foraging bouts because they have to get nutrient ingestion to feed their offspring and they have to move long distances, that impacts the offspring. The offspring being left alone, not having the relationship, the close relationship, or add predators into that situation as well. So you want a lot of resources tight in an area. We want these wildlife, these wildlife areas to be where there's a lot of value of forage. There's good cover component, and that mother does not have to move a lot. And I see many, 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 many times a lot of mothers getting hit by vehicles. Car deer collisions happening a lot frequently during that fawning season where fawns are being dropped. And it always bothers me because to me it's a form of not necessarily bad decisions by the mother all the time, but her putting in herself in a situation where she has to move a lot because the forage quality is not there. And that bothers me. So create a complete property. That's the example. Now, how deer move on the landscape, where pressure comes from is a big piece of this. We want the deer taking the same access routes, same winds. As human pressure starts, that just changes. Deer start circling, they're checking, their environments. They have more direct movement with a purpose. We want deer meandering at slow rates, at slower intervals, and consistent across the landscape. And how do we do that? What are the factors? Food, cover, available resources, social resources as well. So we want the deer to social interact. We use a term with our animals. We create enrichment factors, things that are going to make an animal feel safer in the landscape because they have a lot of social interaction and awareness. And so when we have good perennial browse, mass-producing trees, stable bedding, consistent water resources, we shrink their home ranges down, just like the example with that big buck I mentioned earlier. And we reduce their exploratory behavior. And they increase site fidelity, meaning they're there at a higher rate. And that's really the goal. And landscape predictability is more about being complex in your mindset and not just thinking about that one diversity pocket. Having these complex, dense, diverse environments increases use, period. And vigilance, when a deer has to be more vigilant, it costs them energy. I'm all about the law of conservation, keeping it simple and not having an animal essentially have to waste energy for no particular reason, because that depletes an animal's reserves. And guess what? It reduces the ability to produce giant antlers. And most of the time, that's what most of us are focused on. Deer need to know where danger comes from. So be consistent about where you and how you apply pressure to the animal. And don't be random in your disturbance. When you create stress levels in these animals, that affects their physiology. And we see that all the time in workplace situations where individuals are constantly stressed. They have gray hair. They're overweight. Generally, they're depressed more often. And so we want things to be more predictable. We want to lower the stress levels, lower their cortisol rates, increase the time that they're feeding. We want them going into these big environments. I want to be like the Midwest. I want deer to improve. I want higher fawn survival. I want bigger body mass and antler growth. I want them to going into the winter months with, a lot of internal and external fat on their bodies. I want them to look physically healthy. And there's just a few simple questions, and I'm going to end with this, that you need to ask yourself. to build a property that has higher landscape predictability. It's really easy. Do the deer bed in the same general areas year to year? Seasonally, do they bed in the same areas? Are the trails stable or constantly shifting? Do deer move during daylight hours inside and outside of cover? Do feeding bouts last longer than 15 to 20 minutes? Do they flee or casually drift when they're bumped? Or do they take long distance movements in a flight response situation? When you start to answer those questions, you will determine if you're on a low or high pressure property. And again, some of these properties in the Midwest are low pressure, easily to predict. Do not put these individuals that hunt these low pressure properties on pedestals. It's the worst mistake you can make because that doesn't relate necessarily to your property. So looking at their environment, you want to replicate their environment. You don't want to envy them. You want to replicate your environment. And that's the objective. Watch those TV shows. Watch the animals' response to pressure. Watch how they use their environments. There's a difference. The drone guys that are out there are not detecting that difference. Their awareness isn't from a, you know, understanding behavioral ecology. Their focus is trying to find numbers of deer, and how they use the landscape is going to vary based on the conditions that are present. All right, that's it for me today. Hopefully everybody got a lot out of this. Please go in and give this a 5-star review. We're going to talk about property management and design, considering some of these topics in the next podcast. I appreciate everyone's support. Go on, 5-star review. Thanks for listening. See ya.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.
Close your eyes, exhale, feel your body relax, and let go of whatever you're carrying today.
Well, I'm letting go of the worry that I wouldn't get my new contacts in time for this class. I got them delivered free from 1-800-CONTACTS. Oh my gosh, they're so fast.
And breathe.
Oh, sorry. I almost couldn't breathe when I saw the discount they gave me on my first order. Oh, sorry. Namaste.
Visit 1-800-CONTACTS.com today to save on your first order.
1-800-CONTACTS.
My dad taught me a lot, including how easy it is to forget to cancel things. So I downloaded Experian, my BFF, big financial friend. Experian could help me cancel my unused subscriptions and lower my bills, saving me hundreds a year. Get started with the Experian app today. Your big financial friend's here to help you save smarter. Results will vary. Not all bills or subscriptions eligible. Savings not guaranteed. $631 a year. Average savings with 1+ negotiations and 1+ cancellations. Paid membership with connected payment account required. See Experian.com for details. Experian.
Ready to relax in your dream bath retreat without the stress of figuring out every detail yourself? At the Home Depot, your bath upgrade is covered. Shop fully designed rooms and curated bath collections to go from inspiration to transformation fast. Savings of up to 40% will make it easier on your budget. And find everything you need, from tubs to toilets and all the tile in between, to bring your vision to life. The Home Depot. Dream baths built here.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.